Good morning. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this morning is to my right, Justice Sue Walker. To my left, Justice Bill Meyer.
Good morning.
I'm Leanne Dofano. And you are the only case we have set for oral submission this morning, so you get our undivided attention. I understand both sides are ready. All right, then if you'll call the case, please. You're up. And when you start talking, the green light will magically appear.
All right. May it please the court. I'm Wallace Brady, and this appeal is from a decision dismissing the health care case in the lower court because of deficiencies in the report of the doctors that required to be filed. Now, I did not represent the plaintiff in the lower court. I'm here only on the appeal. And I'm asking for it. I have several issues in my brief, but I'm only going to argue number one and number three because of the time constraints. I've only got 15 minutes, and believe me, that's really a hard thing to do to a lawyer, to make him quit talking at the end of 15 minutes. I could just tell funny stories for 15 minutes and just barely be getting started. But anyway, what happened involving my point number one and number two is that the plaintiff in this case pled two causes of action. Number one, what I would call a malpractice case. That is to say that he pled that the defendants had not complied with the applicable standards of care in the medical profession. And he also pled a failure to warn of the dangers of this particular operation. That is the what I might call an informed consent cause of action. I say that all of the objections that the defendant made to the reports that his expert witnesses filed went to the malpractice case. Failure to inform was not mentioned in any of the objections that the defendant filed. The defendant is going to argue with me about that, and I'm hoping to distinguish his argument from the actual facts. But at any rate, I say that the court erred in dismissing the informed consent case because there was no objection ever made to the reports of the doctors insofar as informed consent was concerned. The whole thing went to the malpractice case, and then the judge dismissed all causes of action, which I think is an abuse of discretion. I hope today to distinguish some of the opponents' cases that they cited and tell you why I don't think they applied. Number one, the hospital district argues that I can't assert an informed consent case against the hospital. And he cites a case from the Dallas Court of Appeals saying that only the treating doctor has a duty to warn the patient of the dangers of surgery. That the case he cited is Espelin versus Children's Medical Center of Dallas. Now, that's what that case says, but there's a distinguishing difference between that case and ours. In that case, the Court of Appeals went to considerable difficulty to show that the doctor and the hospital were both independent contractors, that the doctor was not an employee of the hospital. In this case, the plaintiff pled that the doctor was acting at all times as an employee of the hospital, actual employee of the hospital. When the doctor is an employee of the hospital, then the hospital is responsible for all of the failures that the doctor doesn't do. That, of course, the question of employee-employer status is a fact question that's going to have to be tried in the trial court. It's never reached. But since it was pled, I think we're going to have to, for purposes of this argument, we're going to have to assume that the doctor was indeed an employee of the hospital, and that the hospital was itself practicing medicine by and through its employees. And as such, they're responsible for the employees' derelictions. If you will read that Espelin case, I think you will agree with me that the reason they went to considerable length to show that under the facts of that case, the doctor involved were not employees of the hospital, that they were independent contractors. And that's why I don't think that that case can be held to be controlling in this situation. Now, another argument that they made is that they really did object to the failure to give notice to the informed consent procedure of the case, because they objected that the reports failed to go to the question of causation. Now, if you read their objections, however, I don't think that you can say that that was an objection to the failure to discuss causation on the informed consent portion of the case. The reason for that, any fair reading of the language in context will show that they are referring back to the question of malpractice. Just a minute, I didn't bring it with me. Hold on just a minute. The objection was made to all of the expert witnesses who filed a report. But I'm just looking at the objection that was made to Massey Smith, because the objections in all cases were more or less the same. And I'm going to paragraph D of their objection, where it says, "This report does not provide a fair summary of Dr. Smith's opinions as to the date of the report regarding the causal relationship between TCHD's alleged failure to meet the standard of care and the injury, harm, or damages claimed. Dr. Smith's report failed to state with particularity any breach by TCHD of the applicable standard of care and how the breach proximately caused the injuries complained of by plaintiff. Dr. Smith's only statement is that plaintiff's pain is due to surgical intervention on June 8, 2009. There is no statement that the surgery on that date violated the standard of care or that the violation of the standard of care caused the pain. There is no statement that the surgery is performed by TCHD. The report must explain the basis, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The report is therefore inadequate and fails to establish the requisite causal connection." Now, he does say that the report fails to establish the requisite causal connection, but if you look at that paragraph as a whole, I think you're going to have to say that that they never discussed the question of causal connection between the failure to warn and the injury. It just doesn't. The fact is, if you look at any of these objections, you can't find where the failure to warn is mentioned one time anywhere in these objections. I think any fair statement is that when they talk about the requisite causal connection, they're talking about the causal connection between the failure to comply with the meet the standard of care involved in this case. In other words, this goes only to the malpractice case. Now, I don't see how there's any way that we could sustain this verdict. Opposing counsel goes to cites some interesting cases to show that the reports filed by the plaintiff were inadequate, and he may very well be right. But he should have made that argument in the trial court instead of waiting until the Court of Appeals. By not making any objection, he deprived the plaintiff of any chance that he had to correct or to amend those portions of the reports. If excuse me, I have a little frog. I've been fighting a little sore throat here. In case I get a little rough, I hope that you'll be able. Excuse me. Hope that you'll be able to understand me. In my book, if you don't make an objection to a possible defect in the party's pleadings or reports or whatever that you're required to file, then you've waived the objection that you possibly could have made. Since there was no objection made to the failure to show a causal connection between the failure to warn as opposed to the failure to observe or to comply with the regular standards of care, then that case can't be sustained. You can possibly dismiss the case insofar as it concerns the failure to comply with the usual standards of care, because they did make an objection to that portion of the reports. There's no way you can sustain it insofar as the failure to give warning or informed consent portion of the case on that ground, because there was no objection made. That being the case, regardless of what we do on the informed on the malpractice portion of the case, which is the subject of point number two in my brief, no matter what we do on that, we're going to have to reverse this thing insofar as the other portion of the case is concerned. What he's really doing is asserting two causes of action, and Civil Practices and Remedies Code requires him to file a report of the medical experts in this kind of case.
Let me see if I understand exactly what you're saying. You're saying that even absent any medical malpractice, the surgery had its risks, and there was a duty to warn of the risks, even if the surgery were performed perfectly with no breaches whatsoever. Risks existed, and there was an obligation on the part of the care provider, whether it was the hospital, the doctor, to warn the patient of the prospective risks, even in the case of no malpractice whatsoever. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's two different and separate causes of action. Even if and I wanted to make that point. In fact, you made it better than I did. I could possibly have done. Even if the required standard of care is completely complied with. Fact is, even if the operation is done perfectly, failure to warn is a grounds for liability. He has to be given a chance to back out of something that's risky. As it turned out, the surgery didn't come out that well, and he wound up, with a permanently disabled foot and ankle. And since there was, now he also said, you got to remember, he pled that there was no warning given, whatever. And he brought in an expert witness report to show that his signature on the waiver form that the hospital had was a forgery. And so now that's another fact issue. But I think we've got to assume, for purposes of this argument, that yes, he wasn't given any warning, and yes, his signature was a forgery. Now, of course, the the expert who was going to testify, the question document expert who was going to testify, that his signature was a forgery. They objected to him, too, because he didn't state what the cause and what the standard of care was, and that he didn't comply with the standard of care. And he didn't establish a causal connection between the failure to comply with the standard of care and the injury. But you don't have to prove actual malpractice on a failure to warn case. You got an absolute obligation to give him a chance to inform him what the risk of the surgery are and give him a chance to back out. And that wasn't done. And at least we got to assume that it wasn't done for purposes of this case. We hadn't heard any evidence on it at all. This just got dismissed because of the reports and the alleged deficiencies in the report. I think I'm through. My little red light just came on.
Are there any questions? Your questions? Judge, you have any questions? Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Mr. Rady's letter to the court asking for oral argument centered in on the concept that an expert report was, in fact, not required for an informed consent case. But just to briefly talk about the structure of the code with this, of course, Chapter 74 deals with all healthcare liability claims. Section 351 requires that every healthcare liability claim have an expert report. The Section 74.101 through 104 that deal with consent issues don't accept that from that requirement, although it may narrow the focus of that some. Now, in this particular procedure is an ankle fusion, and it is not listed in the disclosure panel requirements or the list of procedures, and so therefore there's not a set written document prescribed by that disclosure panel that has to be presented to the patient for the surgery. So that takes us back to the duties of Section 101, which is to disclose the risk that would cause a reasonable person to decide they didn't want to have the surgery. So, and then also another court has said that, or defined that as risks that are inherent to that surgery that are directly connected to it and then would cause a reasonable person not to have the surgery. It doesn't require that that be in writing. It can be done verbally, but the disclosure of the risk, and Judge Dothano, you asked if the disclosure had to be done even if the surgery was done perfectly, and it is correct, the disclosure still has to be done, but if there's no injury, then the causation issue and the injury issue would be before the court. So in this particular case, they have pled actually several different, they've pled no consent and lack of consent and a surgery that exceeded the consent. But the facts as they're pled in that third amended petition show that Mr. Meadows came to the hospital for an ankle surgery. He wanted to have cement removed from his ankle that had been put in there in the past to stabilize it. And so it's clear that he did come for a surgery and that he did consent to a surgery. And so the real issue here is, did the hospital and the physicians exceed the scope of his consent? And that's going to be a fact issue if we get to that. But the argument today from Mr. Brady that we didn't divide our objections by the causes of actions is inapplicable. The procedure, of course, is that the plaintiff files his healthcare liability claim, and then within 120 days, he must serve medical reports on the healthcare providers. And then the healthcare providers must object if they want to challenge those reports. And you can challenge either on the qualifications of the expert, which we did, and on the sufficiency of the reports themselves. Do they have the elements in them that the statutes require? And we also objected on that basis. So our objections are to the medical reports that are filed. They're not objections to the causes of action and don't have to be separated in this case. And to say that we didn't object or make that clear, I think would really be not factual when you consider, for example, the only physician expert is Dr. Shearshow, And his entire medical report deals with basically the consent form and the consent issue, and we objected to that. There's nothing in Dr. Shearshaw's report about whether the surgery was done correctly or anything else in that regard, so obviously our objection to that report had to be onto the informed consent case. So the expert opinion to come in and show the court that this is a cause of action that can go forward is going to have to show the court that there is something that the hospital did wrong or its employees did wrong. So if our duty is to disclose the risk that would be inherent in the procedure and that would cause a reasonable person not to have the surgery, somebody has to tell the court what those risks are. And my submission to you would be lawyers can't do that, that it would require a physician who practiced in the area of ankle surgeries to do that. In this particular case, the man that performed the surgery is an orthopedic surgeon, and so somebody would need to say, I practice in this area of orthopedics, I've done ankle surgeries, I am familiar with the risk of that surgery, and here are those risks. And I've looked at the chart, and I've looked at the consent form, and the doctor that performed the surgery did not disclose those risks. And that's not done. Dr. Shearshaw does not do that, and none of the other experts do that either.
But is that the issue? Isn't the issue that whatever risks show to have been disclosed on the form, there's no evidence that it was actually shown to the patient because their position is the signature was forged?
Well, if I may, first of all, the pleadings do not say that it was forged. That's brought about in Curtis Baggett's expert report, although he's not qualified to be an expert for this. It's pled
that... not qualified to be a handwriting expert?
Well, I don't believe he's qualified to be a handwriting expert, and actually there's a case that says that as well before. But in this particular case, since it is a healthcare liability claim, the expert reports are supposed to go to the healthcare issues.
But that's not their issue. Their issue
is an issue because it is informed consent case is a healthcare liability case.
What doctor is going to be able to testify to a forged signature? What doctor is qualified to testify?
He doesn't have to do that, though.
Documents.
If Dr. Stewart that did the surgery says, I set Mr. Meadows down and I spent 30 minutes with him explaining the risk of surgery.
That's your witness. That's
and the jury believes that, then the defendant wins. There's no requirement in this case that there be a written form. Now, I am certainly not admitting or conceding that that form was forged, and we will oppose that vigorously. But in this particular case, although Dr. Shearshaw certainly focuses on that form, it's not required. It can be done verbally. And then the expert has to tell you, these are the risks that must be disclosed. Now, if he looks at the chart and there's nothing in the chart that says that it was disclosed and the form doesn't disclose it or they dispute the form, then that is probably enough if he says those things to get by the requirement and pass the objection and proceed on to the development of the case. But he doesn't do that. He talks about what he calls joint commission, the joint commission standards. He really never deals with actual standard of care as to what has to be disclosed, and he never deals with causation. Now, regardless of any other issues in there, the code is clear that only a physician can testify as to causation on this issue. And the only physician that filed the report is Dr. Shearshaw. Curtis Baggett is a handwriting examiner, and Dr. Smith is a podiatrist, which in Texas is not a physician. So Dr. Shearshaw is the only man, the only witness here that can get them by the issue of causation, and he never addresses causation. And so even if you don't go with the other issues, I don't see any way past the fact that there is no expert opinion on causation. And because of that, the reports are deficient because that is a required element in the reports.
What causation? If they're saying there was never any disclosure. What causation are you talking about?
There has to be a connection between the risk that was not disclosed and an injury to the patient.
So you're
for example, if I didn't disclose to you in an ankle surgery that one leg might come out shorter than the other, and indeed one leg did come out shorter than the other, that would be an inherent risk, and you could prove cause by proving that the surgery caused that and the lack of consent caused that. And then you would have to have the expert also say, well, that is the risk, if you had told him that, that he might have reasonably decided not to have the surgery for. Well, I don't want to have one leg that's shorter than the other. I'd rather have ankle pain, so no, I don't want to do the surgery. But the physician, none of the people say anything about what those risks are and what has to be disclosed. They just focus totally on that written form and don't deal with the elements that are required in the statutes. Now, for example, there was a case decided over in Dallas called Hightower versus Baylor. I did not cite it in my brief. It says a physician's duty is to disclose the all risks or hazards that could influence a reasonable person in making the decision to consent. And it says expert testimony must establish that a risk is inherent to the treatment or the procedure. And back even further in what was actually a directed verdict case, which is Barclay versus Campbell, the Texas Supreme Court also said that expert testimony is required to prove that the medical condition complained of is a risk inherent in the medical procedure that was performed. And so, for example, in this case, if the plaintiff came forward and said, after I had that surgery, I've had a sore throat and I can't sing. Well, that's not a risk that's inherent in the surgery, and so that would fail the test of this particular issue. And then I would just also...
Counsel,
I'm sorry, yes, sir.
On those cases? They're not listed in your...
I did not do them. The Hightower versus Baylor is 348 Southwest 3rd Edition 512. It's a Dallas Court of Appeals case, and review was denied on that. And then Barclay versus Campbell is 704 Southwest 2nd 8, and that's a 1986 case out of the Supreme Court.
Thank you.
Those are cases that went to trial?
Those, the first case, the Supreme Court case, which is Barclay, went to trial and the court issued a directed verdict. And that was appealed. And the directed verdict was affirmed because the plaintiff failed to prove the connection between the risk and the lack of disclosure of the risk and the injury that was caused. On the Dallas case, Hightower versus Baylor, it's a case just like the one today. It was done on a dismissal of the claims because of failure to file an adequate medical report. So the hospital district would submit to the court, since the standard is abuse of discretion, that the judge looking at these reports and my brief goes to some length, as Mr. Brady said, to point out both the deficits in the reports themselves and in the qualifications of the experts, that if he applied those failures and applied the law to those facts, that he did not abuse his discretion by granting our objections and dismissing the case. In addition to that, the plaintiff really never sought any relief along the way that they could have. In this case, the trial attorney, who was not Mr. Brady, did write a letter to Judge Evans requesting the chance to file an additional written response, and Judge Evans granted that, and that was done, but did not make a request to supplement those reports or tender those a supplemental report. And then a motion for a new trial was filed, but it was never heard, and no supplemental reports were tendered either. So no opportunity was given to the judge to see if this could be cured, if they had the ability to do it or not. And even in this appeal, Mr. Meadows does not ask you to give him a 30-day extension. He asks you to find that the objections were invalid and that those reports are valid as they stand, and to remand this case for trial on the merits. And so in that particular case, you're going to actually would have to make a finding to give him what he wants, that all of these objections are bad and that the report should stand as they were.
All right. It sounded like you were saying only a doctor practicing in the very field could have done the report, the question document report. That wasn't really what you were saying. You were saying the question document report regarding a forged signature standing alone without an additional affidavit from a doctor in the field is insufficient rather than
I think that's close to what I was saying.
Okay.
I'm really, I guess, probably even going further to say that the issue of whether that was forged or not is not a determining issue. The issue was the disclosure made, whether verbally or in writing? And if it was not, what had to be disclosed?
If they had said it wasn't made verbally, you would have said, yes, but they have to show it was also wasn't made in writing. So
I promise you I wouldn't say that because that's not what the sections on the disclosure panel say. It has to be in writing with specific listed risk if it is a procedure listed, but not otherwise.
You have questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay.
Do I have 5 minutes?
5 minutes rebuttal.
Oh, I'll talk quick. Just a minute here. Before I get started, is this yours?
Yes, thank you.
All right. Well, of course, opposing counsel has discussed if Dr. So-and-so testified in such and such a way and they believed him, then they'd win. Okay, that's fine. That would happen. But we're just asking a chance to let the jury decide whether to believe him or not. What we're saying is that this ought to get reversed because they didn't object to the reports insofar as they concerned the informed consent portion of the case. Since they didn't object to it, they waived it. Now, he brought up some very good points saying that, yes, there were some deficiencies insofar as informed consent were concerned in the reports. And I think he may be right, but we never got a chance to amend them because he didn't make an objection to it. And we don't make an objection, then it'll walk. Now, he also said...
After the trial court, there was a hearing on a motion to dismiss, and at that point you could have requested 30 more days, correct?
No, I couldn't because I wasn't in the case.
Okay, other counsel could have.
I don't know what she did. On that point, what she said to the court when she went to the hearing. I wasn't there.
Well, all I'm saying is that at some point there was a hearing set before the trial court on the motion to dismiss. Mm-hmm. And so at some point, whoever was trial counsel was aware that there were allegations that the reports were defective mm-hmm. in some regard. And at that point, a request for a 30-day extension could have been made.
I don't know. She did make a request for time to write an additional written report, and she did. But they didn't rule on it. Now another issue I want to bring up. Opposing counsel said that only a doctor who practices in the same field as the defendant doctor can testify against the defendant doctor. That's not true. What the statute says is that only a doctor who practices in the same field as the defendant can testify as to the defendant's failure to comply with the standards, medical standards of care. He doesn't say he can't testify against the defendant as to other issues, such as the results of the surgery. I don't even think you have to be a doctor to say to testify as to that. Here's the thing. Before he went into the surgery, the lower portion of his leg was 2 feet long, and when it came out, it was 1 foot long. I think you could reasonably assume that, yes, the surgery caused it because there wasn't anything else that could have caused it. Now, Dr. Smith was a podiatrist, and he couldn't testify as to the standard of care, but he did testify. He did write a report saying that the surgery is the cause of his problems. And that's not
a question of a standard of care. It's just a test. It's just a report saying that yes, this is that this surgery is what caused the problems that he now suffers from. And that being the case, I think he can testify as to that.
So you're saying that you don't need a medical doctor in the same field to testify to do a report as to causation?
Not the results of the surgery. He could barred by statute from testifying as to the failure of the defendant doctor to comply with medical standards of care. But that's not a question of medical standards of care. That's just a question of result. And there's nothing in the statute that bars him from doing that. For that reason, and for the reasons I've discussed in my opening statement, I'm asking that this case be reversed at least as to the question of informed consent, if not as to the whole case. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your argument here today and your answering our questions. Your case is submitted, and you're free to go about your business. This court will be adjourned.
All right. The Honorable Court of Appeal of the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.
Okay. Well, I'll see you.